Good morning, my name is Clinton. I'll be doing today's Bible reading. Today we have two Bible readings. First one being Zechariah 7, 1 to 13, and then the second one's going to be Zechariah 8, 19 to 23. So if you're going to follow along in the Pew Bibles, it's page 664. In the fourth year of King Darius, the word of the Lord came to Zechariah on the fourth day of the ninth month, the month of Kislev. The people of Bethel had sent Shizar and Regem-Melech together with their men to entreat the Lord by asking the priests of the house of the Lord Almighty and the prophets, "Should I mourn and fast in the fifth month as I've done for so many years?" Then the word of the Lord Almighty came to me, "Ask all the people of the land and the priests, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh month for the past 70 years, was it really for me that you fasted? And when you were eating and drinking, were you not just feasting for yourselves? Are these not the words the Lord proclaimed through the earlier prophets when Jerusalem and its surrounding towns were at rest and prosperous, and the Negev and the western foothills were settled?" And the word of the Lord came again to Zechariah. This is what the Lord Almighty said: "Administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the foreigner or the poor. Do not plot evil against each other." But they refused to pay attention. Stubbornly they turned their backs and covered their ears. They made their hearts as hard as flint and would not listen to the law or to the words the Lord Almighty had sent by his Spirit through the earlier prophets. So the Lord Almighty was very angry. "When I called, they did not listen. So when they called, I would not listen," said the Lord Almighty. So the second reading is Zechariah 8, 19 to 23. This is what the Lord Almighty says: "The fasts of the fourth, fifth, seventh, and tenth months will become joyful and glad occasions and happy festivals for Judah. Therefore, love truth and peace." This is what the Lord Almighty says: "Many people and inhabitants of many cities will yet come, and inhabitants of one city will go to another and say, 'Let us go at once to entreat the Lord and seek the Lord Almighty.' I myself am going. And many people and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem to seek the Lord Almighty and to entreat him." This is what the Lord Almighty says: "In those days, 10 people from all languages and nations will take firm hold of one Jew by his hem of his robe and say, 'Let us go with you, because we have heard that God is with you.'"
Thanks, brother. Well, hey, my name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to do that after we're done in here. I've got 25 minutes or so to try and explain Zechariah 7 through 8. And can I just start by saying that I am so proud of us as a church for tackling the book of Zechariah. It would be easy to make the preaching program just based on nice little nuggets of truth that make you feel good. We could preach on, "I can do all things through him who gives me strength." And you go, feels great. You say, "The Lord is my shepherd." You say, I love that. You read Zechariah 1 through 6 and you go, There's so much to be interpreted. There's so many slightly confusing things at first glance. There's different colored horsemen, there's myrtle trees, there's flying cinnamon scrolls, and it's like, I want to try something. I know this is an Anglican church, but we're going to do a raise your hand poll, right? You're allowed to do that if you want. Have you been finding, if you've been here for the last 3 weeks, have you been finding Zechariah 1 through 6 needs a little bit of extra attention, a little bit of extra work? Thank you for your honesty. If you've been finding that, can I encourage you that today is a little bit easier? Right? When they put the preaching program together and said you get Zechariah 7 through 8, I said, thank you so much. Because Zechariah through 8 is like a river of calm in the middle of just some crazy prophecies and oracles and things, right? Zechariah is basically in three sections, right? You can tell that by looking at the structural markers that divide the whole thing up. And so chapters 1 through 6, right? Lots of prophecies, lots of oracles, lots of things to discern. Chapters 9 through 14, we're going to go back to the land of prophecies and images and all those things. But can I encourage you, actually, chapters 9 through 14, which we're coming to next week, are some of the most quoted verses in the entire New Testament. So you say, what were the New Testament authors thinking about? What were they reflecting on when they wanted to interpret what Jesus did and why it matters? They were thinking about Zechariah 9 through 14, really significantly. But today, we're in the middle third of Zechariah. It's chapters 7 through 8. And it breaks up into three neat sections as well. So Zechariah is in three sections, and 7 through 8 is in three sections. Can you look at your Bible if you've got one, or look at the screen if you don't? Chapter 7, verse 4 says, "The word of the Lord Almighty came to me." Now you get the same phrase in chapter 8, verse 1, "The word of the Lord Almighty came to me." And you get the same phrase at the start of verse 18 in chapter 8, "The word of the Lord Almighty came to me." This is a quick how do you read your Bible moment. If you see a repeated phrase, tune in. It probably matters. And in this case, it's functioning as a structural marker. It's telling us this is the start of a new thought. This is the start of a new thing. If you're really eagle-eyed and you want to try and convince me that chapter 7 through 8 introduces a new section as well, we can talk about that afterwards. But for today, let's say there's three main sections. And what I'd actually love to do is to show you that they represent three different time zones, right? So did anyone come to that, hands up again, right? Did anybody come to that Michael Stead introduction to Zechariah night in the auditorium here? Thank you for coming. Some of us tuned in through Growth Group. Michael Stead actually wrote a commentary on Zechariah 7 through 8. And in it, he says the three sections, past, present, and future. Past, present, and future. So chapter 7, starting at 7 verse 4, they're reflecting on what they have been doing to worship God, and they're asking, should we continue doing it that same way? Chapter 8, starting at chapter 8 verse 1, they're asking questions about their present, because they're coming back to the land, and God's got some positive promises about how he's going to relate to them in the land. And that tiny little bit at the end, starting at verse 18 of chapter 8, is all about their future. But what I'd love to do for the next 3 minutes is convince you that it's all about our present. Sometimes when we come to the Bible, we say, where am I? How does this relate to me? Can I try and show you that you are in the back end of chapter 8? Let me try and show that to you. Chapter 8, verse 20. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Many people and the inhabitants of many cities will yet come. And the inhabitants of one city will go to another and say, let us go at once to entreat the Lord and seek the Lord Almighty. I myself am going. And many peoples and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem to seek the Lord Almighty and to entreat him. Now pause there. Let's pull up the Bible timeline. If you were the original recipients of this verse, and you heard that people from powerful nations were going to come to Jerusalem, you're thinking, oh man, not again. Because, really, really small writing, can you see, Jerusalem was destroyed 586 BC. That was the Babylonian Empire. They came and just beat up the whole city. They destroyed the temple. That was the last time that a powerful nation had come to Jerusalem. Now, if we go back to the verse, can you see the change that Zechariah is saying will happen? Many peoples and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem, verse 22, to seek the Lord Almighty and to entreat him. If you're reading just the Old Testament, you'd be forgiven for thinking that God was only for the descendants of Abraham. There are hints the whole way through, like people from other countries who end up incorporating themselves into God's people. But by and large, it feels like God is mostly concerned with the people of Abraham. But here's a hint that in their future, one day, people from all nations, all over the globe, will come in to worship the one true God. So verse 23, and this is where you and I are in the scriptures. This is what the Lord Almighty says. In those days, 10 people from all languages and nations will take firm hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and say, let us go with you, because we've heard that God is with you. Little hint there about Jesus. What he does at Christmas is he enters into the world. He becomes Emmanuel, God with us. But can you see where you are on the screen right now? You say, we are the 10 people. From all nations and tribes and languages who have said, I want in on the God who originally reveals himself to Abraham but is now known throughout the world. And we grab hold of the hem of one Jew, his name is Jesus, and we say, I want in because you've got access to the one true God. See, it's past, present, and future, chapter 7, 8, and the end of 8. And at the end of 8, this is our present. This is what God is doing in the world. This is what is currently happening until one day Jesus comes back and wraps it all up. We are part of the 10 people, and this is God's mission and primary agenda in the world. But anyway, that's just a warm-up. What I want to do is talk about chapter 7. Can we talk about chapter 7 today? It breaks into three thirds, right? Chapter 7, chapter 8, and the end of chapter 8. For today, I'd love to mostly focus for the next 15, 20 minutes on chapter 7. Can I get a thumbs up? That sounds like an okay plan, worth your time on a Sunday morning. Here we go. It's quite simple. It's a question and an answer. No prophecies, no images, quite simple. The question comes in verse 3. Should I mourn and fast in the fifth month as I've done for so many years? Now, the background to make all of this make sense is that Bible timeline again, right? If you're new to all of these things, here's the cheat code to how all of this works. In 586 BC, Jerusalem is destroyed. And do you see those two down arrows, right? If you're in the overflow section, can you see those on the TV? The two down arrows, that says there's two waves of God's people getting moved out of Jerusalem, scattered throughout the nations. And that little Z represents the book of Zechariah because it's in the middle of three separate waves of return to Jerusalem. Now, here's the thing that explains verse 3, right? When their temple got destroyed in the fifth month of 586 BC, they decided we should mourn that. We should remember that. That is a moment of national crisis. How should we mourn that? Let's establish a fast. So they create a fast to commemorate the horrible moment, which was the destruction of their temple. And for 70 years, while they've been in exile, they've been practicing this fast. But now they're part of the three up arrows. They're coming back and they're asking, should we keep going with that? That thing that commemorated the destruction of the temple, now that we're rebuilding the temple, should we keep having the fast? That's the question. And here's the answer in verse 5. Ask all the people of the land and the priests, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months, he adds a seventh month fast as well, for the past 70 years, was it really for me that you fasted? Now pause there for a second. Fasting, a little sidebar here. We're very interested in fasting, right? And lots of growth groups this week, you might have spent a lot of time discussing fasting. That's excellent, and we're so interested in the idea of fasting that in January, we are going to spend a whole week preaching specifically on fasting. But today, we're not going to go that deep on it because the main focus of what's going on in this particular verse here is in the repeated phrase between verse 5 and 6. Can you see what's repeated between 5 and 6? Verse 6, when you were eating and drinking, were you not just fasting for yourselves? See, they've asked a question about an external religious ceremonial moment in their calendar. Zechariah is more interested in talking about their internal motivation. This fits with the way the God of the Bible always comes back to us. We often ask questions about, what should I do? And he's often more interested in talking about, who are you doing it for? Where is your ultimate allegiance? We often want to talk about the hands. God so often wants to talk about the heart. And he says, when you fasted and mourned, was it really for me? When you feasted, was it really for me? Now, pause there. I had a question as I read this through. The second bit made sense to me. I understand how you can feast for yourself. If you said, our temple got destroyed, so we're going to have an annual feast of the mince pie, I'd be like, that makes sense. That's just for you. That's not actually for God. Like, I understand how you can feast for yourself. I don't understand how you fast for yourself. Fasting doesn't feel good. How do you fast for yourself? In fact, just play that out. How do you end up serving God, but you're actually just serving yourself? How does the human heart do this? How do you give money, but you're ultimately just giving for yourself? How do you serve the poor, but you're actually just doing something ultimately for yourself? How crazy is it that our hearts are able to twist even moments of celebration to God and to somehow twist them about ourselves? There's something crazily corrupted inside of us that we are capable of doing such a thing. And yet that seems to be what was happening. They were fasting, they were feasting, but ultimately, from the outside, they looked like they were great worshippers. But on the inside, God's got a probing question for them. Do you mind if I ask a question here today that might land or it might miss for you specifically? Is there anything that God never actually asked you to do that you're very committed to, but it's actually just for yourself? Because that's pretty much what's going on here. Let's think about it this way. Their faith had turned inward. And so it doesn't surprise us when God lays it out in the positive that he instructs them to turn their faith outward. Have a look at verse 9. This is what the Lord Almighty said. Administer true justice. Show mercy and compassion to one another. Don't oppress the widow, or the fatherless, the foreigner, the poor. Don't plot evil against each other. God is very interested in how we relate to one another. God is very interested in how we relate to each other. And this is a modern thing that we might need to just correct inside of ourselves, right? We've become very interested in the vertical and the personal relationship with God. Is this right? We say, I love relating to God. I love praying to God. I love my moment of song to God. But ultimately, vertical worship of God is meant to flow out into the horizontal. When someone came to Jesus and they said, what's the greatest commandment? He said, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. There's the vertical and the horizontal. And in these verses, we have on display for us particularly what God is asking for them to pay attention to, what he is concerned for, and he wants them to make it the center of what they're concerned for. Can I point out a couple of details about what we see here on the screen? The first one is that they've already been told this before, because God has always been a God of the marginalized. Have a look at verse 11, right? But they refused to pay attention. Stubbornly, they turned their backs and covered their ears. Right at the end of verse 14, this is how they made the pleasant land desolate. Can I say that in other words? God, before the exile, before Jerusalem got destroyed, God had told them to care about each other. And he says, why did you get kicked out of the land? How did you make the pleasant land desolate? It's because I told you this before, but you la 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 la. I told you this before, but you turned your back. I told you this before, and in the language there, a couple of verses later, it talks about how you made your hearts as hard as a diamond. They've been told this before because God has always been a God of the lowly. And he's telling them again. Now that they're back in the land, they got a chance to set themselves up again. We get a bit of a chance to set ourselves up again as we think about January or the new year. How do you want next year to be different to this year? We get a moment to replan, to relaunch ourselves. This is their relaunch moment. And God says, I want what I wanted before. I want you to care about what I care about. I want your faith not just to be you and me, but I want it to overflow into the people around you. And so let's come back to verse 9. This is what the Lord Almighty said. First one, administer true justice. Administer true justice. And in case we missed it, it does come up again in chapter 8. We can pull that up on the screen. These are the things you are to do. Speak the truth to each other. Render true and sound judgment in your courts. He wants us to administer, or he wants his people back then, and I take it today, he still cares about true justice. just a word to us specifically. If I preach this sermon to us right now in this room, in this part of Sydney, my guess would be we have a higher than usual percentage of people involved in justice-based activities Monday through Friday. Right? Sometimes the church does a bad job of separating your Sunday from your Monday through Friday, and your Saturday is just for you, right? But let me at least connect up your Sunday and your Monday through Friday. Some of us in the room, you work as lawyers. You're often at court. Some of us are working in justice in terms of we create legislation. We create the rules about how this whole system works. Some of us, we spend a lot of time trying to help two little people have justice with each other, right? Sort out little disputes. A lot of us are engaged in justice making and justice administrating activities Monday through Friday. Can I just say to you today that your work matters? What you do during the week really matters. And you get an opportunity to join with one of the things that God cares about in administering true justice. What a great way to work. Administer true justice. Next one, show mercy and compassion to one another. I've got a couple of things to say here. Let's see how many of them I miss. The first one is, can I draw together justice and mercy for you there? You see, administer true justice, show mercy. And this is a particular comment to you if you are newer to faith, or if you're still considering, do I want to be a Christian? Do I want to stay a Christian? How does all of this Christian stuff work? Can I just give you two big words to chew on? Justice and mercy. If God was just, he does need to fix the things in this world that are broken. He needs to make right the things that people do against each other. If God is merciful, then actually we get off, even though we also have been agents of injustice. Here's how the cross works, the very center of Christianity. It's where justice meets mercy. It's where God says, I am going to actually punish the sins of the world, and I'm going to be merciful to the sinners. How does that work? Because I'm going to let my son pay the price as your substitute, so that the guilty party goes free and yet justice is done. If you're here today considering the things of faith, justice and mercy are top tier tickets in God's agenda, and at the cross is where they meet. And we do well to reflect his emphasis on justice, mercy, compassion. Can I say something really positive to celebrate the work of some of the things happening in this church? We use Slack for internal communications here at church. Here's a Slack message from the boss that I got this week. He says, FYI for Sunday, from Compassion, 89 children. The Compassion is a charity, by the way. They're not the entirety of what it means to practice compassion, but they're a pretty good shout. From Compassion, 89 children, 22 countries are sponsored by people who've indicated they attend this church. This includes 17 Indonesian children, 9 Filipino, and there's probably more sponsors out there who haven't nominated their church. So I just want to say, great job. I'm really encouraged that so many of us are trying to do something tangible and practical to reflect the heart of God towards other people who might have less. Let's come back to verse 9. Administer true justice. Show mercy and compassion to one another. Verse 10, do not oppress, and then it's got four categories there. This is not the entirety of what it means to be marginalized, but they're four very helpful flashpoints for discussion. Do not oppress the widow, the fatherless, the foreigner, or the poor. And I just want to again boast about us. There are a whole bunch of things that we as a group, individually and together, have given ourselves to. I'm involved in none of the things I'm about to talk about. But I would really love to say great job for doing something tangible in each of these four categories. For example, it says, do not oppress the widow. You say, where are the marginalized people in Ku-ring-gai? One of the categories you've got to consider would be the aged, right? And so I'm so excited that we are running a church service in a nursing home. I think we've got a picture of it that can come up here. This is such a tangible way to extend the love of Jesus, personal attention, to each member who comes along. I think it's wonderful that we're doing something tangible to care for the aged. The next category in this letter here is do not oppress the fatherless. And I just want to say there's at least one member of our congregation, next picture, who is actively kind of setting forward to do these kind of things. He got in a little magazine, said it's okay if I put this picture up here today. And we say, caring for people who don't have parents to care for them in the same way is such a beautiful expression of the Father heart of God. And this is happening amongst us. This is a part of what our body is doing in the world. It says, do not oppress the foreigner. And I want to say one of the most tangible ways that we do that is on a Monday morning, this place fills up with people learning everyday English. And we say, we'd love to help you kind of engage as much as you can in this community. We'd love to teach you English. We'd love to make it free. And apparently the classes are good because more and more people keep on coming. Last category there, do not oppress the poor. And I say that every Christmas, it does seem, I've been here for, this will be my third Christmas at this church. There's always some kind of an appeal to put things in boxes and we're going to go take it to people who have less things in boxes. So this is Luca last year going out to our partner church, Chester Hill. And to all of this is just to say, I'm so excited about what we as a body are already doing. And I'm excited if you think about the potential here in this room. Objectively, based on the data, you say, okay, the people in this room, not all of us are doing that well, and some of us got really grumpy that we didn't get the rate cut we were hoping for, but overall, we are a relatively affluent group. And so as I look out today, I say there is great potential for good in this room, and I'd be really excited to just turn up the knob and say, let's do it. Like, let's be that bunch of people who, in the words of Zechariah, actually administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another, and give ourselves to protecting people and building up people who otherwise in society might be left to the side. We're drawing near a close, and I'd love to draw your attention to Matthew chapter 23. Because there's an incredible parallel account of what's happening in Zechariah 7 with an interaction that Jesus has. Because here's what's happening in Zechariah. In Zechariah, they're very concerned with their religious duty. And Zechariah says, can you please be concerned with the people around you? Have a look at this interaction between Jesus and the Pharisees. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law. Justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Can I tell you something that happened to me on Wednesday that doesn't make me look very good? I like to practice my talks by just standing up here and talking to an empty room. So these chairs have copped a lot of horrible first drafts. And the doors at the back weren't open because it was just a Wednesday at church. But somebody came to the back doors and I could see them knocking on the back doors. And my first thought to myself was, oh, I'm trying to do my religious thing here. I'm trying to get my sermon ready. I'm trying to serve God here and you're interrupting me. But you know, you go to the back door, you say, hey, how you going? She goes, hey, is the church open for prayer? I just need 5 minutes to pray. And you're like, Zechariah 7 says, probably yes. why don't you come on in? James chapter 1 verse 27, this is the early followers of Jesus, they got it. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress. That's what true religion looks like. And all of this makes sense when you reflect on the ministry of Jesus. Band, do you guys want to come up? You see, Jesus was very tuned into the reality of Zechariah 8. Jesus came to preach the kingdom. Jesus came to make justice and mercy meet. Jesus came for the forgiveness of sins. Jesus came so that people from all tribes and nations and tongues would worship the one true God. And along the way, he was deeply distractible, not in the kind of scrolling your phone way, but by the needs of the people around him. People always coming up to him and saying, can these kids talk to you? And the disciples are like, no, get them away. Jesus is like, yeah, let the kids come. And Jesus is off to preach the gospel somewhere and somebody says, I need healing. And Jesus says, come here. I think there's such a beautiful example in the ministry of Jesus. You say, this guy, what was near to his heart was he was here to help people become disciples. And along the way, he was very interested in mercy, compassion, lifting up the marginalized. He was a marginalized guy who died a marginalized death. And in his spiritual poverty, we become spiritually rich. I'm going to say a prayer and then we're going to sing about exactly that. Would you like to pray with me? God, we thank you so much that you are a God of the lowly, a God of the marginalized. We ask that you would draw our attention to things that you would have for us. I pray that you would inspire people to act in new ways today. I pray that you'd help us to care so deeply about people's salvation. And I pray that along the way, you'd help us to really care about people and their immediate needs in front of us. God, you're so good to us, and we thank you for loving us even when we were spiritually poor and making us spiritually rich. And everyone who agreed said,